Hello and welcome to Dynasty As They Want to Be, a podcast where we drill into every episode of the iconic 1980s television series, Dynasty. I'm your host, Derek J. Lang, and with me is my co-host, Kyler K. Jafari.
Bonjour.
I want to start out the episode by telling you a little bit about a nightmare that I had last night. So we went out to a lovely dinner and had some cocktails and a couple of glasses of wine and came home and we were like, let's watch Dynasty. Let's watch the next episode and get ready for the pod.
Drunk plans.
We put it on, you know, it's available on Amazon Prime. And we queued up this week's episode, which is titled Crystal's Lie, and started watching, and I never finished watching. Yeah, I kind of have this problem where I'm a bit of a narcoleptic, so yeah, I think it was
But that's
like,
self-diagnosed, right?
It's self-diagnosed. It's not an actual clinical.
A little too much WebMD for you.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think I got as far as dun 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 dun.
Well, I just kind of looked over. I'm like, oh, you've fallen asleep again. This is what you do. And I'm just like, screw it. I'm going to keep watching anyway. I don't care.
Well, then I woke up and I thought I was having a nightmare because Lindsay was on my screen like, screaming about something, and I was like, what, where am I, what's happening, what's going on? And I was like, oh, it's Dynasty.
Just another day of Dynasty. Maybe that is a nightmare to wake up every day with Dynasty on your TV.
Well, it's certainly a nightmare to wake up with.
Be like what my life seems like these days.
You love it. Anyway, I apologize for falling asleep because as soon as I woke up and I saw her crazy, ugly crying face, I was like, turn it off. I'm going to bed.
Well, that's why we're having a lot of coffee right now because we got to stay awake.
This is definitely the most caffeinated I felt while recording Dynasty As They Want to Be. I'm like,
hey, you're got like the jitters. Climbing the walls, and like all we had was like burnt toast for breakfast. So I don't know what we're going to do if we don't hurry up and get this episode over with.
Well, I blame you because we had a lovely French press, or what I thought was a lovely French press, but actually there was like sludge in it. So I think we were literally drinking coffee grounds.
I was ambitious, shall we say. I thought I could get 8 cups out of the French press,
which makes 4 cups.
I think it's designed for
keeping
four.
Track at home.
So I was like, I'm just gonna try this once and see what happens. And I'll just describe it as it queefed when I tried to press the knob down.
No, please. People are going to turn it off the podcast.
It did. And then the sludge came out of the top. And then I felt bad because I was like, oh, this is expensive coffee. I don't want to dump this. I'm not going to abandon ship.
And you totally fucking trolled me because I'm just like, coffee.
I wasn't
going
to tell you.
Drinking. And then like on my last
This is like how the cook is not supposed to complain about their own cooking, right? So you just put it on the table and hope for the best.
It's not right, Kyler. It's not right. Yeah, on my last sip, I'm like, tastes solid. And then I like spit it out.
You're like eating your coffee.
Yeah. I'm like, why do I have to chew this right now? Normally I drink coffee.
Toothsome.
And then I like spat it out like that mobster
that
character.
Mulholland Drive reference.
Yeah. Which you understood that when I did it.
Yeah. You didn't even have to tell me. I knew exactly what you were doing.
Anyway, so it's actually probably a good thing because so much shit went down in this episode. We have a lot to discuss.
Oh,
I think we
the
need
characters
to just
did all the drinking for us, so we just need coffee. Yeah. They can have all of the booze because this was an incredible episode, I think.
Yeah, I don't know if I feel hungover from all the cocktails and wine we had last night or from watching this insane episode. So let's just get right into it, okay?
Let's.
Okay, so as I mentioned, I was awoken by the character of Lindsay
Blaze. Wailing by the car.
Yeah, she was a wreck in this episode, as she is in every episode that she appears in.
I'm starting to think she's two-dimensional.
I've said that from the beginning, that she's one-dimensional. Like, clearly the Shapiros are a talented couple. Those are the writers and creators of Dynasty. But I just don't think they understand how to have a fully fleshed out teenage
Well,
character.
So yeah, this character is here to be maybe that the audience that's a little bit younger might identify with her, perhaps. So they're trying to have this teenage storyline, but it doesn't seem fully fleshed out. And I don't think it goes too much further, by the way. But
yeah. So what goes on in this episode is she overhears a conversation with her parents, Matthew and Claudia. Basically, we know that they got married young and have been together basically their whole lives. And they kind of talk to each other about how, yeah, it kind of sucked that you had Lindsay at age 16, right? Claudia.
Something
had
like
her.
16, yeah.
So,
and I'm doing the math. Lindsay's now 14. So Claudia's 30, but looks 40.
Well,
in a
finally, we have a confirmation on somebody's age on this show.
True.
Because as we keep repeating.
But they make you do the math. They're not just going to come out and tell you how old these people are. So.
Yeah. No, I'm taking notes. But yeah, so they got knocked up and then got married and lived unhappily ever after.
You had so much going for you. I mean, ahead of you, you know. You never got to go to college. You didn't even finish.
It doesn't matter. We were kids. We got into trouble. We made a mistake. Oh, we have to figure out a way to stop punishing each other, to forgive each other for that, huh?
And Lindsay overhears this and once again goes into a crazy tizzy for the whole rest of the episode. It kind of comes to a head at school, a little friend of hers.
Oh, but you're missing the whole... My favorite scene in this is she goes to the county clerk's office and she's pulling up the good old-fashioned microfilm.
Oh, yes, we do have a
microfilm. We get a microfilm moment. Actually, you're right. It was fiche. It was on the flat plastic slide,
right?
I
love a microfiche research moment in popular culture.
Well, here's the thing. The Shapiros managed to hit on all of the boilerplate, you know, topics. We've got the... Got pregnant young and had to get married.
Check.
We've got the teenager always on the verge of a nervous breakdown.
Check.
The microfiche moment, of course.
Big check there.
We get the dive bar brawling. That's another, you know, cliche that likes to turn up in TV from this time period. So
check,
I don't know.
Check.
There's just a lot of these things, but it's a soap opera, and they're doing all these things pretty well, I think. So it's hanging together successfully for me.
Yeah. Anyway, it doesn't really wrap up. She learns.
Well, I think
this
on the microfiche, she's was that the marriage certificate or the birth certificate she was looking at?
I think it was the birth certificate.
Showing that they each had
different
last names
when she was born.
I think that's what I was making up in my head, but I wasn't really looking very closely anyway. But somehow that microfiche is the key to all of her questions, and she figures out that they were not married when she was born.
Yeah, and so that leads to ugly cry.
Or conceived, I should say.
At school, that leads to ugly cry. At home, it leads to ugly cry in the bathroom.
I guess she's got resting cry face.
She really does, and it's so annoying.
Because even when she's not crying, she looks like she's about to or just did.
And I'm sure Katie Kurtzman is a lovely person, but I don't want to see her crying anymore.
I mean, it's hard to do this character a lot of service, I'm afraid, because this character really is just a vehicle to get this storyline into the show, so... I don't blame her.
Yeah. Anyway, nothing really comes of it. She figures it out and it puts her into a depression. So enough with that. Matthew has his own problems going on. And boy, does he have issues this episode. What should we start with first? I guess all of the drama at the oil rig.
Well, drama at the oil rig meaning what? You're talking...
Meaning he's figured out who the real saboteur is.
Well, but that drama really plays out in the bar later.
Well, yeah, but I mean, we should explain that he... you know, they all thought that Stephen Carrington was the one who took this bolt out that brought the operation to a halt.
Right. Stephen Carrington was the sacrificial lamb, but turns out he was set up by Fast Eddie.
Yeah, Eddie the roustabout oil rig guy. So Matthew heads over to my favorite bar. It makes a triumphant return, the Hillside.
This might actually be a different bar on the inside, though,
oh,
right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think
different
the first
set.
Time we saw it was a set, and this like it looks like it was
this
filmed on
this could have been a real
location.
Bar.
Yes. Yeah.
That's expensive.
Yeah, so Matthew walks in kind of smug.
And don't forget these amazing POV shots with the handheld camera work.
Yeah, we get a little bit of different cinematography. cinematography. Well,
it's sort of suggesting Matthew's like he's nuts right now. He's on the prowl.
Yeah, he is going to take down Eddie, who is currently pool sharking it, I guess. Matthew's goal here is to get Eddie to admit that he did it and who's behind this, because Eddie is not just doing it for shits and giggles. Like, this is obviously a business maneuver. So they proceed to once again beat the shit out of each other.
Was this just like you could just beat up people in bars back then? I mean, I've been to a bar a million times in a million kinds of bars, and I've never seen this before, but it's always on TV.
And it's always Matthew Blaisdell. I think we've seen him get into like four or five different bouts of fisticuffs. It's insane.
Well, it's decently choreographed for your typical TV fight scene.
Oh, of the fight scenes that we've seen on this television program, this is the best one. They are going all over on the pool table, on top of each other.
I feel like
the cues, bam.
The only miss was when they got against the cues and the cues didn't all fall over or snap into pieces or something. I needed that moment.
I wanted those things to snap like toothpicks, but I did like it when they got on top of each other on the pool table and then were just pummeling each other's faces. Mm.
Corner pocket, baby. my favorite touch from that scene was the Russian water torture maneuver.
Yeah, so basically Matthew was waterboarding the fuck out of Eddie, yeah, which led him to admitting, dum dum dum,
that Blake Carrington put him up to all of this.
Which, was that a surprise to you? It wasn't really.
It's not a
surprise,
but it's also like, well, I didn't think about that. But yes, there it is. And it's just another one of Blake's nasty oil maneuvers.
Yeah. And what I immediately started questioning was, okay, so Blake Carrington's behind it. Not a big shock because he's such a maniacal villain. But does Blake know that Steven took the fall for this? Like, that was where my brain immediately went to, because that's even more evil.
Yes, and actually Matthew calls that out later in Blake's boardroom, or not office, not boardroom. But, and so, yes, I mean, did he know that? I think he would have had to, because
he knows everything,
yes,
apparently.
Right.
Like, that's been mentioned several times in the show, is that he has spies everywhere. And he does seem to know everything before his kids know, before his wife knows. And he doesn't completely admit to it, but it seems like he did know that, which is nasty.
It's like worse than nasty. As we find out later, he's willing to sacrifice even members of his own family for certain goals.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get to it, but Blake has reached the darkest depths of humanity in this episode.
Oh, this
episode,
and that's just, it gets dark.
The beginning. That's Ooh, just yeah. the beginning.
It's just classic Blake nastiness, you know, which it gets even nastier because then he's telling him, you know, you've been pining for Crystal all this time and I'm married to her and I want you to tell me that you still love her and that you think of her every day and every night. Or I'm not going to let my guys off of your oil rig and I'll get you somehow, you know. And it's just like, oh, that's like quite an ultimatum to lay on the table. And of course, Matthew's not going to take it.
Yeah. Not only does he admit that he was like fucking with him, he's even saying, I'm going to continue to fuck with you.
Yes.
It's
very old school mafia style, which Matthew even says, like, that's the old way of doing things. And you can't be an oil baron and a tycoon, you know, like it's 100 years ago anymore. Like, there's new ways of doing things.
You know, Blake, I used to respect you. I used to think you were the smartest man I'd ever known. But you're losing it. You're dying in it. You're operating the old way. Trouble is, the day of the old tycoon, the oil baron, is over. And like them, you don't have any values anymore. You don't give a damn about anybody or anything.
Oh, come on, Matthew. You're talking about America, the American dream. Laissez-faire, mother, apple pie, petroleum.
I'm talking about how you poison just about every damn thing you touch.
So Matthew also has trouble at home, not just with Lindsay, but with Claudia as well.
Well, I'm glad we finally got to the bottom of their marriage, because you already could tell from day one, Matthew's screwing around with Crystal.
Uh-huh.
And then, so you're like, well, you already know this is probably not a great marriage. Then they have all the, you know, sex problems and she's going to a therapist. And so they're not in a happy marriage. But then you finally get to the bottom of it. Oh, she was, you know, it was a shotgun wedding and it was all just for Lindsay. So now it gets even worse because him blowing out Eddie turns into Eddie going to the bookstore where I guess
Claudia now has a part-time
job. Women in the workplace is a hot topic back then.
Well, it's just a part-time job. People aren't going
to
talk.
That's right. Matthew's not going to have to go get hormone shots just because his wife has to work for the, you know, to make the house payment. So he goes to the bookstore. Eddie goes to the bookstore and does this classic nasty move where he's going to get back at Matthew. And so he's going to tell Matthew's wife, at her place of work, of all things, that
unprofessional,
totally. You know, that Matthew and Crystal have been putting the train in the tunnel, and
while she was locked up or in the hospital. Well, as she points out, she wasn't locked up, she was just admitted into the hospital. But she, well, first he just says that he was fucking around on her, and then she demands a name and he gives it up and he says it's Crystal Carrington, which we kind of know that she felt
she
like they had a connection.
That. Yeah. Yes.
But she's pissed, rightfully so.
Also, she's working at a bookstore. So here's more of these literary references that the Shapiros like to drop into things.
I know. Was she inspired by Stephen to go work at a bookstore? Kind of interesting.
He gave her a book, so yes, and she did.
That's all it takes. She... You give me a book, and I just want to work around them part time.
Well, she did bite into the apple in the living room at the beginning of the episode.
I was waiting for you to call that metaphor out.
Even receiving the knowledge, which she goes to work at the bookstore and she receives the knowledge that Matthew and Crystal have been screwing around.
Yeah, and it kind of wraps up for them back in bed. Matthew, after all his drama, comes back and is like, you know, honey, let's go to therapy together. Let's work on this. And with this new knowledge that she has now, she's like, F that. Like, I don't want to go to therapy with you.
I'm going to bed now.
Yeah.
turns the lights off. That's like a classic passive aggressive move, like staying up for your cheating husband to come home and then you go to bed and turn the lights out on him. Like, she could have gone to bed 5 minutes before, like, but she waited for him to get home so she could have that moment.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't
very passive aggressive.
But you know, they say don't go to bed angry, but that bitch went to bed angry.
Yeah, she was
for
hot.
Sure. The other kind of issue that Matthew had to deal with this episode, God, there were like so many problems for him, was after he figured out that Eddie was the saboteur, he wanted to hire Stephen back as a nice goodwill gesture. But Stephen was like, no thanks.
He already moved on.
Matthew, they strung me up. They took a rope and they tied it around my ankles and they hoisted me up and they let me hang there. And you didn't even talk to me. You just took it for granted that the faggot did it.
I guess we have to settle this business with Stephen and Ted. He gets a telegram, which of course, nosy sister Fallon wants to see what it's all about. Of course, she knows it's from Ted, right? Because it's like her MO with her brother is this whole gay storyline. And I guess Ted is going to come out to LA or San Francisco or both. And that's a springboard for Steven to come see him.
Yeah, I thought we were done with Ted, but apparently is not done with Stephen Carrington. He wants to meet up with him on the West Coast on this little trip that he's on. And Stephen doesn't seem that into it.
I'm wondering, I mean, of course, I guess Ted's actually on business, but it's like, is he just pulling another one of his stalker moves where he flies out to the coast and it's really just to see Stephen? I mean, this guy's a poor lovesick fool. Essentially, I mean, he's totally lost in Stephen.
Yeah. Well, and Fallon takes more of an interest than ever in this part of Stephen's life. They have kind of a nice heart-to-heart.
I like how she has that uncomfortable conversation with him. Like, have you ever been with a woman? Have you tried it?
I know. I was bummed by that.
Maybe you'd find out you're not gay.
I know. I was bummed by that because Fallon seems more evolved than everybody
else. She's definitely
else.
More advanced than pretty much everybody else in the house.
But then she starts saying, well, try being with the woman. If you haven't done it, maybe you like it. And it's like, that's not really how it works, sister.
I mean, at least she was soft about that. Like, if she wasn't going for a hard gay conversion therapy, like, you know, a la Walter. However, Maybe she was just saying you should experiment. You know, maybe that's all she was getting at.
Yeah, but I think her main objective here is to solidify Steven as a power player in the Carrington clan.
Yes, she is certainly preserving an alliance with him because she knows Daddy's a little bit not to be trusted.
Yeah, and she wants him to do what it takes to ascend, and that means suppressing your homosexuality in 1981. Mm-hmm. Still.
Well, that's what she says, basically, like, just do and be, but why can't you be happy with the Carrington heritage and all the money you're going to get one day if you just behave like Daddy wants you to?
And then she takes it so far to use this information that Ted is going to be on the West Coast, Best Coast, that she meets up with him at LAX. I was very surprised we get an exterior shot with the theme
building.
Yeah,
this is where Fallon starts to get a little bit meddlesome, right? But this is her
a
character.
A little bit. She fucking flew to LA to go meet up with her brother's ex-gay lover.
You got
to
call out the classic exterior establishing shot of LAX in 1981, or when, I guess, 1981, with the amazing architecture that's still visible today.
Yeah, but the theme building.
But it's all been so built up around you barely would notice it anymore, which is sad.
Yeah.
Also, the interior of the airport is definitely not... I mean, maybe this was inside LAX. I'm sure they didn't actually shoot there, but it's very late 1970s decor.
Yeah.
It's quite an airport on the inside.
There's like Spanish tile and neon green maps, and it did look pretty luscious. So yeah, Fallon meets up with Ted and says, let me give you a ride to San Francisco in the Carrington private jet.
Oh no, she says, turn in your ticket. I'll give you a lift. Of course, it's on the private jet.
Uh-huh. I was just thinking, like, how that would never work today. Like, you know, just popping in the private jet and then, like, just return the ticket for a full refund without, you know, having to pay a $200
change
fee.
It's so much more complicated to get on a plane these days.
But, yeah, they just hop on there and have a nice little chat as they're flying up to San Fran.
I mean, I guess she's just trying to charm him so that he'll lay off her brother. Is that what's going on? I couldn't really figure out what she was doing.
Oh, damn. I was going to ask you. I didn't understand what they were talking about either.
I think the writers just wanted another excuse to put somebody on a private jet and use that set because they spent a lot of money on that set. And, you know, it's fun to watch Fallon doing her things. So.
Well, I thought on one hand she was trying to talk him out of connecting with her brother because it was going to stop him ascending to power.
Ted is so charming that she kind of reverses course on that method.
Yeah, but then, yeah, again, they were having like a kind of a nice connection, and then he invited her to have some lobster in San Francisco, and she seemed kind of giddy. So I couldn't figure out what was really going on.
Well,
maybe
that's her style. She just loves flying around three states over to eat dinner with somebody. I mean, that's, you know, she's bored and rich and has Daddy's private jet. So she's like, okay, I'm down for that. You're not such a bad guy.
Yeah. Hopefully we'll get more info on what was going on there. But it kind of...
I mean, he did kind of get into some of that dialogue with, have you ever really loved somebody? So it turns around the conversation she was having with Steven about, have you ever slept with a woman? Have you ever tried it? And Ted's basically telling her, have you ever loved somebody?
Right.
Have
she doesn't understand, you know, the feelings that they actually have. And it seems like she doesn't.
Yes.
The other thing that Ted does that's really interesting is that he calls out Blake Carrington for all of his nasty business practices, which I guess have been reported in the news.
Okay, and we've seen Blake engaging in nasty business practices right in this very episode. And when we say business, that also applies to his marriage, which is clearly still a business deal. He says something really rotten to him. So Blake goes from the boardroom to the bedroom, and Crystal's in lots of hot water.
Well, is she, though? As we remember from the last episode, she pawned off a necklace to bail out Blaisdell and Lancashire, unbeknownst to her hubby. And he figures out that they've been bailed out, and he's thinking
he
everybody is a suspect. Colby,
everybody but his own wife.
Somebody named Harrison. Oh, yeah. No, he doesn't suspect her at all, but she knows. And he kind of starts the episode on a tirade, sort of trying to figure it out.
She is worried that he is going to find out eventually, and that's why she's a little bit forthcoming and saying, it's not your friends. I know them. They would never do that to you. So it's she's almost confessing, but she never quite gets to that next step to say it out loud.
I think she's just trying to talk him off of the ledge because he starts going into that crazy rage mode. And I hope I think she hopes that he doesn't ever find out and just kind of like lets it go.
I think
but
she's
that's
got a
very
sense,
naive of
I
her.
I think she has a sense of fatalism on this one. I think she knows it's going to come back to her at some point. But that's just me reading into the character. I mean, the dialogue and the scene don't play out that way. So Blake's in the library, like frantically going through all of his, you know, PowerPoints and pie charts and Excel spreadsheets, trying to figure out what's going on with his oil business and probably also trying to figure out where that money came from for Matthew Blaisdell. Who knows? He's just having general work anxiety and he's taking it home with him to the library. Crystal is like trying to snap him out of it. She brings hot coffee, but he's like, no, I need
I didn't
scotch.
Want any of that.
Yeah, he's already got something to drink and it ain't as caffeinated as what she brought him.
Yeah, he's just kind of on edge the whole episode. Every time he comes on screen, it's just like he's going to snap, or he does snap in some cases. He kind of shoos her away, and then she runs across Fallon coming home drunk off her ass. And
I think she was stoned.
Oh, it could be both, yeah.
Out of her mind.
It's a kind of inconsequential scene, but it's some really great,
it's
like,
actually,
drunk acting
it,
from
unfortunately,
Pamela
it has
Sue
nothing
Martin.
To do with anything else, but it's actually one of my favorite moments out of this
it's
episode.
It's so funny.
I mean, PSM is working her magic. It's the most crappy dialogue, but she is just on fire. She's like chewing scenery.
Hi! Hello, Fallon. Did you have a good time? Yes, I did. Sorry to disappoint you.
Why would that disappoint me?
Well, because my husband's out of town. And according to your bourgeois ethical system, I should have been locked in my room with a Bronte novel.
Yeah, I think what we get from it is that even though she's in this kind of arranged marriage situation, she's still living her life, honey. She's going to do what she wants to do.
Oh, she's happy Jeff's like trapped over in the Iranian revolution or whatever, the oil that's tied up over there. And she's happy for that because now she can go back to being Freaky Fallon, you know, pre-wedding style.
Yeah, we get a couple throwaway lines that that Jeff Colby has actually been sent to the Mideast by Cecil Colby. So that's why he's absent and not part of any of the plot lines. And yeah, she's just living life and going and interfering with her brother.
I think what we like about the scene even more than just her hammy acting is Crystal, the looks again, man. She acts with her eyes. I've never seen this before. You know, they say Betty Davis eyes, but it should be
Linda Evans eyes.
She is just saying nothing and everything. I just love the reaction to Fallon. She's just like, okay, I see what you've been doing, and I'm not having any of this. And I'm going to leave the room now.
There's also excellent prop work from PSM with this big, giant feather white boa.
She loves that damn boa. You know, she wore that boa a few episodes ago.
I think she might have upgraded it. This one seemed a little bit fluffier than the previous one.
And maybe it's went from chicken feathers to ostrich feathers.
Yeah, but all of that sort of drunken frivolity and joy is completely obliterated when Blake goes into the closet and sees that Crystal has been taking birth control.
But I like the little touch that he discovers it in the pocket of her, you know, blue nightie that's hanging up in the closet.
Right, it's in. Then, he just so happens to knock over one of 50 robes
right.
that she has.
I mean, she's only got like an entire walk-in closet full of those, and of course, he figures out very quickly. You know, the camera has to like spell it out for you. It's like, here's this little box, and there's a monthly pill that's supposed to be taken, and like it's like the months are actually like demarcated, and it's like, oh, birth control pills. I couldn't figure that out, but Blake figures it out, and I love that when she gets home, she walks into the bedroom, fur coat flowing, and
after a night out with the girls,
and then she takes one look at Blake, who is trashed on the bed with like a half-empty decanter of scotch.
He's laying on the bed with the decanter in his hand.
This is a classic drunk feeling sorry for yourself image. And Crystal gets one look at this and then turns back and looks at the chair, and there's her blue nightie, and she's like,
that's the nightie where I keep my birth control
nightie.
We have never seen Blake this low, despite his company almost going belly up. Whatever it is, him wanting a child with Crystal is what has sent him to the darkest, deepest place that we've ever seen him go. And what happens next, I don't even know if I can talk about it because it's so bone chilling.
It is. If everything I've seen on Dynasty, not even so far, but for the entire show, I think this might be the most uncomfortable thing. It still does not play today, even. I can't even imagine how scandalized people must have been at the time. He's essentially spousal raping her.
Yeah, it's a marital rape. So he confronts her about the pills. She kind of apologizes.
It starts with this actually very like fun moment where he's going on this like a diatribe.
Is it that I'm surrounded by people who can only betray me? People who say that they believe in me and then don't? My son is in love with another man. My daughter is in love with sex. She's probably still sleeping with every player on my football team. My wife... who knows what my wife is doing behind my back?
What are you doing?
I think he really was putting his hopes of all of the problems that he's been having on this child. Like this child was going to solve everything, which a lot of people do that. And that's what sends him into this rage. But it's completely unforgivable. Well, then he starts grabbing Crystal and
kissing her. It's just so sad because I really liked that diatribe. Like John Forsythe was just really, it was good, you know? It was like, it's almost over dramatic and silly. And then like suddenly he goes into spousal rape mode and it's like, oh, I don't want to keep watching this. And
she runs to the door to get out of the bedroom. He grabs her. He throws her on the bed. He's ripping her clothes off. Like it's definitely marital rape. And it's
there's
disgusting.
No way to slice it. Yeah. And honestly, I don't think anybody can watch this today and not feel like maybe they shouldn't keep watching the show.
It's triggering for sure. And I don't know how I'm going to be able to get through or come back from this, knowing that Blake Carrington is a central character on this show. Like, we're only in season one and he's raping his wife? What the fuck?
The thing is he was being like evil and conniving and manipulative. And then it goes over the line here, and it's no longer just nasty.
And he drank a whole decanter of scotch.
I mean, I think
that doesn't excuse it.
I think that's supposed to excuse the character's behavior, but no.
No. So is that how it ends?
That is how it ends. It doesn't say to be continued, and I hope it is not. I don't want to see any more of this.
I don't want that scene to be continued. I want to wipe it from my memory. I don't know how we like segue from that, but I did want to talk about the interesting, weird musical cues in this episode. Did you notice how like...
Oh, certainly. And well, of course, this last scene we were just talking about, it, part of the heightened sense of drama is this wild, over-the-top soundtrack that's playing behind it, which is, you know, your classic orchestral, you know, rehashing of the Dynasty theme, but it's all dramatic and done in minor chords. And it builds that, you know, that final peak when we go to the end credits. But I think there's also like some really interesting, like, I don't know if it's royalty free jukebox music at the bar during the fight.
Yeah. When Matthew walks into the roadhouse or the hillside,
I'm just trying to imagine like all these tough guys like hustling pool at the dive bar and
listening to Muzak.
They're like listening to Muzak. It's like, I want to know who put that on. Like,
yeah.
That guy's going to be my friend.
And then when Lindsay like is having her emotional breakdown, it's like a crazy like harp music.
Yes.
No,
yes.
It's like the music was just all over. I felt insane this whole episode.
I would say they could dial it down, but this is Dynasty, and I guess things are finally kind of escalating where this show is sort of like discovering what it's going to become, because this is where the previous episode was great with storylines, and this episode is really over the top with the action and the drama and even the unpleasantness. Like it or not, that this episode will stick in your mind. There's no way you can forget this moment in this, in this episode.
Yeah, it was an emotional roller coaster for sure. Let's cleanse our palate and talk about our looks of the week. Well, I still can't even really talk, but let me know what your look of the week was.
My look of the week was most definitely Fallon at the airport. It's this wonderful sort of fur coat, I guess, but it's got tribal bead and feather dangling, like in small details all over it. And then she's got this like totally exaggerated Western hat that's like, is that woven or is that snake skin? I guess it's a woven straw, and it's this Western fantasy that she's doing. And it's kind of out of character, it seems, for her, but she's also like, looks like she's willing to take fashion risks. So I guess it's believable.
Yeah. I didn't know if she was like trying to be undercover or something, but like Ted doesn't know who she is. So is this just what people wore to the airport?
Maybe she
thought
this would be intimidating to Ted if she dressed up like John Wayne.
Maybe she thought it would be appealing. Maybe she's like, well, the village people have a cowboy. I'll dress as one of them.
He's into Westerns.
My look of the week was the very first outfit from Crystal at the beginning of the episode when her and Blake coming out from a night out. He's in a tuxedo and she's wearing what might be the first time we've
the
seen
first
her
time
in a fur, right?
Oh, I thought you were going to call out the fact that it's shoulderless, which I don't think we've ever seen her shoulderless in a dress before.
Oh, the dress or shoulderless. Yeah.
Sorry, bare shoulders.
Yeah, it's a beautiful white dress with like a bejeweled detail on it. And then
you mean on the belt?
Yeah. And she's wearing a fur on top of it. But what I was saying is I think it might be the first time we've seen her wear a fur, which
I can't, she might have worn that fur a couple episodes. But anyway, but it's definitely classic Crystal, and this is one of your first moments in that fur coat.
Yeah, well, we've talked about it a lot before that she hasn't really brought the fashion, and we know she's going to in the next decade of this show, but this is the first time I've seen her in, like, sexy evening wear. Mm-hmm. She's showing a little bit of skin. She's, like, got some great accessories. The earrings that she's wearing glisten and sparkle in that scene, and it's just providing so much light.
Also, the dress itself, I usually don't like this cut of dress, but it's got this peplum detail, but it's not fluffy, it's drapey, and it kind of gives this, again, this Greek goddess look and this white color, but paired with the fur coat seems more like Crystal, so it's not out of character, even though she normally would never wear a bare shoulder dress.
But yeah, two really powerful looks from our femme fatale leading ladies, Fallon and Crystal. That's another episode of Dynasty As They Want to Be. Thank you so much for listening. Kyler, thank you so much for joining me for this really difficult episode.
You're welcome.
I also want to thank DJ Jugo, who composed and created our theme song, and the artist Lindsay Mound, who designed our graphics, which you can see at our website, which is nastypodcast.com. That's nasty, not dynasty, N-A-S-T-Y, podcast.com. You can also follow us on all the places on social media. We're at Nasty Podcast, N-A-S-T-Y-P-O-D-C-A-S-T. Ta-ta.
Love you. Mean it.